It's time for Security Now. Steve Gibson is here with a potpourri of security stories. The end of a famous caller ID spoofing service taken over by the feds now. A funny little scam involving misplaced decimal points. A web surfer from the dark ages that's unfortunately still being widely used. And when passkey is not really passkey. It's all coming up next on Security Now.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is Security Now with Steve Gibson, episode 899. Recorded Tuesday, November 29th, 2022. Freebie bots and evil cameras. This episode of Security Now is brought to you by Collide. Collide is an endpoint security solution that uses the most powerful untapped resource in IT, end users. Visit collide.com/securitynow to learn more and activate a free 14-day trial today. No credit card required. And by Plextrack, the premier cybersecurity reporting and collaboration platform. With Plextrack, you'll streamline the full workflow from testing to reporting to remediation. Visit plextrack.com/twit to claim your free month of the Plextrack platform today. And by NordLayer. NordLayer is a secure network access solution for your business. Join more than 7,000 fully protected organizations by going to nordlayer.com/twit to get your first month free when purchasing an annual subscription. It's time for Security Now, the show where we cover your security and privacy online with the hero of the hour, Mr. Steve Gibson. Hello, Steve.
This is the podcast which is just has a boring start every week because everything works. We're not spending half an hour trying to get, like, stuff on screen or the lighting right.
You just don't see that part.
In the old days,
we did that all the time, didn't we?
Yeah, I mean, well, and I mean, like with different hosts and like juggling things and all that. But it is easier to do a one-on-one podcast than this thing you're doing.
Oh, I see. You saw the rocky start of our previous program.
Yeah, and it's generally like half an hour before things.
Yeah, I know. It's a little weird. It's a little weird. I know.
Speaking of which,
yes,
this is episode 899.
Oh, dear.
I know. And this is the birthday episode, for those who don't know. Leo is celebrating number 66.
Look at that. Yes, Route 66.
Route 66. And on his, for those who don't have video, he just held up an old sign that won't mean anything to anyone much younger than us.
Cookie, lend me your comb. That's all I have to say.
So this was one of those weeks where nothing really stood out, but a lot of interesting things happened. So I grabbed two of the items we're talking about as the title, basically taking from the typical naming of your other podcasts, Leo, where you think, okay, what do we talk about? Let's, you know, come up with something about that. So this is Freebie Bots and Evil Cameras for $8.99, which, and during this podcast, we're going to answer a few questions. What happens when you run a caller ID spoofing service or when you mislist and underprice online goods or click on a phishing link for a cryptocurrency exchange or consider working for an underworld hacking group this is a great podcast, or use a web server from the dark ages in your IoT device.
This is not all one story. These are multiple stories.
Oh, yes. Oh. Yes. Good point. Otherwise, that would be one
really confusing.
Story.
Yes.
Yeah. Or rattle your sabers while attempting to sell closed network systems to your enemies, or decide whether or not to continue to spread your Twitter ad to suspend your Twitter ad buys, or log into Carnival Cruises with a passkey.
Yes.
Or use hardware to sign your code. This week's podcast answers all of those questions and more.
Now that's a tease. You are absolutely now finally, after 899 episodes, conforming to the Twit way.
It only took 17 years, my friend. And
We were heading your way, and you headed our way. So we've met.
And
in the
then
middle.
We're going to defrag a zebra, just to know.
Oh,
just
wait
so
till
so
you see this. That is our picture of the
good.
Week, and a good
that's
one.
That's right.
It is our show today, brought to you by Collide. I love this idea. I think you will too. Collide is user-centered, cross-platform, endpoint security for teams that Slack. But let me explain what that all means. See, Collide came along at a time when we are all, you know, every security professional, every IT person, dealing with this idea that work is forever now going to be hybrid. Some people are going to be in the office. Some people are going to be home, on the road, all over the place, which means endpoint security has gotten much more complex. Of course, we live in an era of BYOD, which means not only do we have to manage our own estate, but we've got this, you know, this shadow IT to worry about. And I think the tendency of a lot of security professionals is lock it down. Whether communicated explicitly or implicitly, the message is the users are your enemy, and you have to wrangle them to make sure they don't do anything bad. You know, treat every device like Fort Knox, put glue, crazy glue in the USB ports, that kind of thing. Here's the problem with that, and you might already be sensing there's a problem with that. Old school device management tools like MDMs force, you know, these disruptive agents onto employees' devices. They slow performance. Employees know they no longer have any privacy, right? They're being spied upon. They know. They feel it. The enemy. So by doing it this way, IT admins and end users are now at each other's, you know, kind of like pushing one against the other. And that creates its own security problem because users, what do? They got their own laptops. They got their own phones. They turn to shadow IT just to do their jobs, just to protect their privacy, just to get performance. It's just not working. You probably already know this, right? It's kind of not the ideal situation. Collide has a better way, and I think this is really clever. Instead of forcing changes on users, Collide sends them security recommendations via Slack DMs. Collide will automatically notify your team when devices are insecure and give them step-by-step instructions on how to solve the problem. For instance, you know, an employee saves their private SSH key in a publicly viewable folder. This is obviously a bad idea. You know this. The employee doesn't, or maybe doesn't think about it. Collide automatically via Slack sends them a DM saying, hey, you know, this is why this is a problem. Here's what's happening, and here's how to fix it. And the employee fixes it. And suddenly they're on the team. Because it turns out employees, you know, want your company to succeed. They want to be secure. They want to be, you know, private. They want it to work. So Collide is actually helping them, giving them step-by-step instructions on how to solve the problem, educating them about company policies, and helping you build a culture in which everyone contributes to security because everyone understands how and why to do it. Now, as an IT admin, you'll love Collide because it provides a single dashboard, lets you monitor the security of the entire fleet, whether Mac, Windows, Linux, it's completely cross-platform. You can see at a glance which employees, for instance, have their disks encrypted or are up to date with their patches or are using a password manager, and more importantly, which ones aren't, making it easy to prove compliance to your auditors, your customers, your leadership, getting employees to do the right thing because it's the right thing. Now they know. So that's Collide. Again, user-centered, cross-platform endpoint security for teams, the Slack. You can meet your compliance goals by putting users first, and I want you to try it. Go to Collide, KOLIDE.com/security now to find out how. If you follow that link, they're going to hook you up with a goodie bag, including these great Collide t-shirts. They've got beer coasters. See Collide.com on the other side. I love this one. There's several of them, but this is the one I like. It's got Pinocchios with their noses going out, and then Honest Security with a Pinocchio without his nose out. It's just a great t-shirt. Feels nice, too. There's the Collide stickers for your laptops. We put them on our refrigerator at work, things like that. And all that just for trying a free trial. No credit card needed. K-O-L-I-D-E, Collide.com/security now. User endpoint security. Done right. Collide. Thank you, Collide, for supporting Security Now. And Steve appreciates that, and I appreciate it. And you, as a listener, support us when you go to that address so that they know you saw it here. Collide.com/security now. I feel like this is almost a dad joke. This picture
well,
of the week. You know?
And I think we've used it before. I mean, it looks familiar to me, but if so, it's kind of fun anyway. So for those who are not seeing our video stream, the caption on this, I know, it's really good. It says, I defragged my zebra. And what we have is what looks like a horse with the front half black and the rear half white. You know,
it's defragged.
It's defragged. Yeah. All of the in-use clusters got pushed to one end, and the free space is on the other. And anyway, just very clever.
I love it.
So
it got us talking about defragging. You don't really do that anymore, right? On most modern operating systems, that's handled.
Correct. Well, actually, the argument that Microsoft has always made, although it's not really as true, is that they were always saying there was no need to defrag NTFS file systems. It was clear that over time, FAT32 file systems became fragmented. And as what we were saying before we got on the air, was I was posing rhetorically the question, how many user centuries of time were lost with us just staring at the defrag screen while the little squares jumped around? It was just wonderful. And I mean, it served no constructive purpose whatsoever, but you know,
we loved
just
it.
Really,
it was fun.
Maybe it was a way of for a geek to have a timeout.
It was it was meditative. Exactly.
Yeah.
But not necessary anymore. That's right. Right.
So Windows says that it defrags automatically in the background, which may be the case. That the one place it can be useful is for data recovery. If your files have been defragmented and you lose somehow, some catastrophe, the entire meta structure of your file system, and you really desperately have to have some file back. But basically, if you've lost all of the metadata, there's no directory hierarchy, no directories, anything, somewhere out on your drive is a blob of space that a file occupies. And if it's contiguous, if it is defragmented, you can find it.
Right.
I mean, it's there in whole. But if it itself is scattered all over the place and it was dependent upon the file system's pointer structure in order to reconstruct that file on the fly, you're really not going to be in such great shape. So, you know, in the old days, the reason we, of course, defragmented was that because seek times were so long, that if pieces of a file were scattered physically around the drive, the drive's head would have to go jumping back and forth around in and out on different tracks, grabbing little pieces of the file in order to get the whole thing. If the file was defragmented, the head would just go to the beginning and just maybe tick over sequentially a few tracks depending upon how large the file was. But so it was less wear and tear on the drive because it wasn't having to jump all over the place just to get one file read. And it was a lot faster because you weren't embedding all these seeks in the middle of a file read.
Of course, there's zero seek time on SSDs.
Right. And so that's what changed. Is when we went to solid state, suddenly all of that head seeking disappeared and you know, it made no difference in terms of performance.
Although Microsoft, quite cleverly, I think, instead of defragging SSDs, if you issue the defrag command, because you still have a defrag, I believe you still have defrag.
Yeah.
Microsoft says, yeah, well, we'll just trim the SSD. It's a way to invoke trim. And so Alan Malventano always said, you should still be defragging because you're now trimming your SSDs. Although I think modern SSDs do trim as well in the background. It's kind of...
Yeah.
That's kind of necessary to keep the speed up.
Yeah, it's actually an OS level thing because the SSD has no knowledge.
Oh, it doesn't know.
Right.
But it could be in the controller. I thought it maybe was in the controller.
No? It's got to be in the OS.
Oh, okay.
So the idea is that the drive itself has no knowledge of the file system. It's file system agnostic. But all of the operating systems now, Linux does it and Windows does it. In fact, it came up relative to SpinRite recently, because if you were to do a write level, like if we're just level 3 or 4 in SpinRite 6.1, that leads the drive to believe, the SSD to believe, that its entire space is now in use. Because when you write to something, it basically flags that area as in use. So what you can then do is, under Windows, there is a way to say, please trim this drive. And under Linux, it sort of does it more easily, but you're also able to force it. And so that is one sort of a power user tip that we'll be getting to at some point with SpinRite is once you do a something on an SSD that writes to the whole thing, you then need to put it back into the operating system to let the OS say, okay, calm down here. These are the areas that are actually in active use, and all the rest of this, no, that's just completely free. And the point is,
it's hard drive garbage collection. We've been talking a lot about memory garbage collection. It's hard drive garbage collection.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. So, I asked the question at the beginning of the show: what happens if you run a commercial caller ID spoofing site? Well, you get your site turns into the top of this podcast. It's on the second page here. Yes, it's and anybody who's interested can go there now, or I went there yesterday. I presume it hasn't changed. ispoof.cc is the domain name. ispoof.cc. And what you get is a big page that says, this website has been seized. And the various emblems of global law enforcement. And it says, this domain has been seized by the Federal Bureau of Investigation and the United States Secret Service in accordance with blah, 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 blah. Anyway, and then we got Europol and London City Police and Cyber Police and all kinds, everybody's involved.
Yeah.
So, okay, get a bit of this interesting bit of happening. Europol and law enforcement agencies from several countries, including the FBI, have seized the servers and websites of iSpoof, which was a service that allowed users to make calls and send SMS messages using spoofed identities. And Leo, if you were curious, I have a link on the page below to the Web Archive Wayback Machine of iSpoof from before it was seized. And it's quite interesting. Anyway, so the service launched in December of 2020 and advertised itself as a way for users to, quote, protect their phone numbers and identities online. But Europol said that iSpoof was widely abused, no kidding, for fraud, because it allowed cybercrime gangs to pose as banks and other financial organizations. An investigation into iSpoof began in 2021 after Dutch police identified the service during one of its fraud investigations. The Dutch police said they linked the service to a web host in Almere, where they deployed a wiretap that allowed them to map the site's reach and learn the identities of its registered users and administrators. Officials said iSpoof had more than, 59,000 registered users before it was taken down just earlier this month. UK Metropolitan Police said that 142 suspects were detained throughout the month of November. So they did a big sting operation globally, with more than 100 individuals detained in the UK alone, including iSpoof's administrators. Europol said iSpoof was being used to place more than 1 million spoofed calls each month, that administrators made more than 3.7 million euros, and that the service has been linked to fraud and losses of more than 115 million euros worldwide. The UK police said they plan to notify all UK users who received spoofed calls made through iSpoof, which is nice of them. So anyway, as I said, I was curious to see what the site looked like before the global takedown, which displayed the, you know, that site seizure page above. So I turned to Internet Archive Project's Wayback Machine, and I found, you know, what I found was just sort of, you know, head shaking. The top of the site's very modern looking homepage, which has sort of has a floating iPhone there on the right, proclaims, "Protect your privacy with custom caller ID." And it says, "You can show any phone number you wish on call display, essentially faking your caller ID." And then down in their features, they said, "Get the ability to change what someone sees on their caller ID display when they receive a phone call from you. They'll never know it was you. You can pick any number you want before you call. Your opposite will be thinking you're someone else. It's easy and works on every phone worldwide!" Exclamation point. So, yeah, you could imagine that, you know, all kinds of bad people with ill intent would be abusing this thing. I mean, like, you know, ex-boyfriends or stalkers or spouses or whomever, you know, whose calls you are not accepting would just, you know, figure out whose call you were accepting and then spoof it in order to get you to answer the phone. I mean, it's awful. Anyway, we've talked a lot about how insecure all of this is. You know, the what is it, SS7, the current signaling system 7, is still allowing this to go on. I finally gave up and disconnected. Actually, I had three. I had a fax line and two landlines, because all I was ever getting was just junk calls. They were just, you know, it was awful. So for me, the most disturbing thing about this story is that the site was up and running for nearly 2 years before it was brought down. You know, that was a ton of damage to be done. And, you know, you can imagine how the word of mouth of this was no doubt spread, you know, in, you know, among the world's shadier types as this thing was allowed to continue. So for what it's worth, I hope there are not alternative sites that are already up and going. I would be surprised, frankly, if there weren't. I should have done a Google and looked around. It didn't occur to me until just now. But still, just, you know, sad that it took that long to get this down. And, you know, we're hearing about the encryption and the tightening of the inter-carrier communications. It's one thing for a carrier to be secure within itself, but it's the gap between carriers where we need security. And they, you know, they're just not in a hurry. That is like, why, you know, we have to make them do this, and there so far that hasn't happened. Okay, what is a freebie bot, you ask? A new class of bot has been identified. And this one does something that would be difficult to predict, but once you hear what it does, you think, huh, is that illegal? Last Tuesday, the anti-bot research and security provider Casada, who we've spoken of before, shared the results of their latest threat intelligence, which detailed the growing prevalence of so-called freebie bots. Freebie bots automatically scan and scrape retail websites searching for and purchasing mispriced goods and services, purchasing these discoveries at scale before the error is found and fixed. Casada, get a load of this. Casada research has found that more than 250 retail companies recently being targeted by freebie bots, with over 7 million messages being sent monthly within freebie communities. Okay, now just to be clear,
this isn't illegal,
right?
No,
well,
this is capitalism, baby. You screwed up.
So just to be clear, these are not furry communities. These are freebie communities, you know, nor are they Furby communities, but that's something else. Members within one popular freebie community used freebie bots to purchase nearly 100,000 products in a single month with a combined retail value of $3.4 million. But Casada's research revealed that due to significant underpricing, the total purchase cost of the goods for the freebie bot users was $882. This allowed some individuals to realize a monthly profit of over $100,000. Top items purchased using freebie bots during this period of time included off-brand sleeveless halter neck mini dresses, get this, Apple MacBook Air laptops, and deep cleansing facial masks. Many pricing.
It's an interesting Venn diagram.
Yeah, I don't know. That's right. What's your overlapping customer matrix? Many pricing errors were the result of a decimal point misplacement, granting discounts as large as 99%. Using the speed and scale of a bot attack to rapidly purchase as much stock of these erroneously priced goods as possible, actors then turn around and resell the goods at the price they should have been, reaping a large profit. So you can see how this could happen, right? Someone keying in a new item's retail listing gets into the habit of entering a decimal point before the last two digits of the price. But then they encounter a price formatted as a whole integer number of dollars without any sense. And without thinking, they place a decimal point before the last two digits, thus inadvertently reducing the listing's price by a factor of 100. It turns out that at scale, across the entire internet, these mistakes happen enough to have spawned the creation of a new class of bot, automated retail mistake finding bots, which will instantly purchase as much of something that's been mispriced as they're able to. So human ingenuity knows no bounds. I suppose that while this might not be technically illegal, you know, it certainly is unethical and dishonorable.
Is it? Is it?
Well,
no.
You know, I mean,
I'm buying it at the listed price.
You know, when the MacBook Air is offered for $50.
Not my problem. Not my problem.
There's something wrong.
That's a good deal. I'll take it.
How many could I have?
I guess it depends. If this is happening to, you know, your local Goodwill store, that's terrible. And that's probably more likely where it is. Apple probably never makes a mistake like this because they have good software. But still.
You're right. It's probably taking advantage of people who can't afford.
Small retailers. Yeah. I mean, Apple's never going to misprice its MacBook Air on its site.
I have seen oddly priced things on Amazon. You probably
sure,
have too,
all the time,
Leo,
yeah.
Where it's just like, what? That can't be right. Yeah. You know? And I just, you know, I mean, it's for a left-handed screwdriver, so I don't need one. But
I'm the kind of guy, and I know you are too, that probably would go, oh, that's a mistake. I'm not going to take advantage of that. So maybe it is unethical. I wouldn't do that. But still, it depends, I guess, on the size of the company. The problem is,
as I said, once you hear the idea, yeah, no one is surprised.
Oh, it happens all the time. Yeah.
That a bot has been created to go scan for these mistakes in real time.
Absolutely.
And buy up the inventory. Wow. Okay. We have the anatomy of a real-time cryptocurrency heist. The group PIXM Security, whose business is to protect end users from credential fraud, recently blogged about the details of an attack group they've been monitoring. The lengths this group will and does go to circumvent, you know, like one of the newer protections, the deliberate authorized device protections we're beginning to see more and more, where like if you go use a new device, you log in with some, like somewhere you haven't logged in before, there's like, whoa, we haven't seen this device before. So we're going to jump you through some extra hoops. So, okay. What's interesting here, and I think you're going to find this really interesting, Leo, is their report in detail of what's behind a true real life phishing exploit. So, okay. And just to give you a hint, scammers will use in-browser chat to initiate a remote desktop session on a victim's device, approve their own device as valid to access the user's account, then drain the cryptocurrency from their wallet or wallets. So, okay, here are the details behind this. When PIXM's threat research team first started tracking the group, they were only targeting Coinbase, right? Like the premier exchange. Then over the past month, the group has increased their coverage, that is the bad guys, have increased their coverage to add support, if you call it that, for MetaMask, Crypto.com, and KuCoin, that's KuCoin, in addition to Coinbase. So now, four. The spoofed domains are the typical, slightly misspelled, in this case, subdomains of AzureWebsites.net. So that's the hub of where they are. And so it'll be like, you know, conbase.azurewebsites.com or .net or something like that. The group employs working effective second factor relay interception when a user is spoofed into going to a lookalike site. Regardless of the credentials the user enters, whether they're legitimate or not, since the spoofing site cannot determine that initially, the user will be moved to a two-step verification page after clicking login, where, depending upon the platform in question, they'll get what they're expecting, which is either prompted for a second factor code or their phone number is prompted and used then to receive a two-factor code. The criminal group will first attempt to relay the credentials they've been given and second-factor codes to the legitimate login portal, which is associated with a platform they're spoofing. Once the user clicks verify, they will be presented with a message, no matter what happens, telling them unauthorized activity has occurred on their account. Well, it turns out it's true, actually, but, you know, this is the bad guys trying to reel them in further. As with the original Coinbase attack, this will initiate a chat window to keep the user on the phishing page in the event the two-factor code should fail, which, of course, the bad guys don't know yet because they'll get prompted for that after they attempt to log in. And the threat actor needs to start, a remote desktop session with the victim to continue with this attack. PIXM wrote that in their experience, regardless of whether the victim enters legitimate credentials or not, the group will chat with the victim to keep them in contact should they need to resend the code or proceed to the second phase of the attack. The criminal gang's willingness to do this significantly increases, I'm sad to say, end user engagement, you know, and their belief that, like, they're talking to the real guys, right? Because there's someone there. For the majority of the attacks which this group carries out, they engage in direct interaction with the user. Their spoofed login and verification portals will, by default, return a login error, as I mentioned, regardless of the actual standing of the user's account or, on the actual exchange and the wallet. Of course, this process is intended to initiate a chat session with a member of the criminal group posing as a customer support representative from the exchange. The criminals will use this interface to attempt to access the users if their initial credential relay failed or if it might have time expired, right? Because we know that these one-time passwords only are limited to 30 seconds and then they change, so it may have expired. If so, they'll prompt the user for their username, password, and second factor authentication code again directly in the chat window. The criminal will then take this directly to a browser on their machine and again try to access the user's account. Should this also fail, for any number of reasons, most common of which is that the device the attacker is using to access the victim's account or wallet is not, as I mentioned before, an authorized device in the user's profile, which probably means unknown IP, or it doesn't have a persistent cookie, which the user's browser would have, even if they've said, I don't want to remain logged in, they would still have that would be a session cookie. Separately, they'd have a persistent cookie, which says this browser has logged in the past. In that case, the attacker will proceed to phase three with the victim. The group uses the talktawk.to, the talk to chat plugin on all the sites, each with the same customer support representative named Veronica. So, you know, be wary if Veronica is talking to you. If the previous efforts have not succeeded in giving the criminal group access to the victim's wallet, they'll instruct the victim to download the TeamViewer remote access control app. They instruct the victim that this is to help them diagnose the issue with their account directly on the user's machine. Once the victim has installed TeamViewer on their device and entered the code provided by the group, right, to initiate the session, the criminal now has full control of this poor user's device and will guide them through the steps required to authorize their device, that is, you know, their own machine, wherever they are, to the victim's account and hijack their session. The criminal has the user navigate to their email inbox associated with the crypto exchange or wallet account. They'll instruct the user to log into their account on the exchange or wallet site. While the user's logging in, the attacker who has control of the victim's device will enter a random character while the victim is entering their password, right? Like interject a character midstream, which will force it to fail. The attacker will then click into the TeamView chat box with the victim's knowledge and ask them to enter their password again, which is just, of course, sending the password now to the criminal in plain text. When the user re-authenticates, the attacker will simultaneously log into the user's account on their own device, which will prompt a new device confirmation link to be sent to the user. The criminal then takes over the user's desktop session and sends themselves via the TeamViewer chat feature the device confirmation link. They can now use this link to validate their own device to access the user's account. The final draining of the user's cryptocurrency funds may then be initiated during, will be initiated during any of the previous attack phases as soon as the bad guys have access to the wallet. It's, of course, only contingent upon the attacker finally being able to successfully authenticate to the victim's account from their own machine, being recognized as an authenticated machine if it hasn't already been. And of course, once the criminal is in the victim's account, they'll immediately begin transferring the cryptocurrency held in any of the victim's wallets to their own. And they keep the victim engaged and waiting as they steal their funds in the background on their own machine, in the event that the service they're draining funds from might require some sort of email or additional phone confirmation of funds transfer. If that's the case, the attacker will assure the victim that this is normal and expected activity related to their account restoration. Once all the funds have been sent from the victim to the criminal's wallet, they end the communication with the victim having emptied the target's wallet. So that should give everyone a sense for how much effort bad guys in some sort of, you know, big cyber farm, you know, cryptocurrency exchange farm, are willing to do to fish people who have cryptocurrency and relieve them of that burden. Amazing.
I wonder if they'll move on now that crypto's gotten less and less valuable.
I don't know.
It's nicely anonymous. It's a great thing to steal because
yes,
it's hard to track.
Toward the end of the podcast, I'm going to talk briefly about my own experience with having an open web server where anyone is able to create an account.
Yikes.
Leo, the internet has become a sewer. And I know from my experience in trying to prevent that there are, and in fact, from talking to some of the anti-forum spam people who I struck up a dialogue with, that there are rooms full of people sitting at screens and keyboards who do nothing but that all day long. And there are different rooms full of similar people who do nothing but respond to phishing cryptocurrency link clicks and then perpetrate all of this, draining people individually of their cryptocurrency. So, you know, it costs, I mean, if they're willing to do that, to create an account against all odds on a web forum, they are certainly willing to do something not that much more in order to get a hold of someone's cryptocurrency wallet that may have a bunch of money in it. Unbelievable. Okay, let's take a break.
Yes.
And I'm going to sip on some water, and we're going to tell everybody why we're here.
Why? Why, I ask you, why? Why? Why are we here? I'll tell you, we're here for you, Steve. There's no question about that. But while you're listening to the show, we'd like to throw in mentions of some of our fine advertisers, because they're almost always products that people who listen to this show might be able to use, like PlexTrack, which is the premier cybersecurity reporting and collaboration platform, transforming the way cybersecurity gets done. Communication is essential in every bit of everything we do, right? You've got to be able to communicate it. It's all the more true if you've got a red team and a blue team, and the red team is doing the pen testing and comes up with the problems and the issues and the things that need to be fixed, and the blue team does the remediation. Communication between the two is vital. PlexTrack makes that easier. Are you ready to gain control of all your tools and data to build more actionable reports more easily, to focus on the right remediation? Are you working now to mature your security posture but struggling to optimize efficiency and facilitate collaboration within your team? PlexTrack is the perfect solution for you. It's a powerful but simple cybersecurity platform that centralizes all your security assessments, all your pen test reports, all your audit findings and vulnerability tracking in one place. It transforms the risk management lifecycle, allowing security teams to generate better reports more easily, more quickly, aggregate and visualize analytics. It's nice to have those pictures, and to collaborate on remediation in real time. How does it do this? The PlexTrack platform addresses pain points across the spectrum of security team workflows and roles. PlexTrack is second to none, for example, in managing offensive testing and reporting security findings. Codes you can embed, drag and drop, put in code samples, screenshots, videos, and any finding. You can import findings from all the tools you use, Nessus, Burp, all the major scanning tools. You can export to custom templates with the click of a button. Analytics and service level agreement functions help you visualize your security posture so you can quickly assess and prioritize and ensure you're tracking remediation efforts to show progress over time. It's absolutely got built-in compatibility with all the leading industry tools and frameworks, all the vulnerability scanners, pen testing as a service platforms, bug bounty tools, adversary emulation plans. And that's always a problem because you have all these tools, right? But they don't talk to one another. PlexTrack is the in-between. It's the glue that puts it all together easily, quickly. You can have templates. You can have automated reporting. You've got robust integrations with Jira and ServiceNow. So you're always closing the loop on the highest priority findings. It just makes sense. It's the piece of the puzzle that's been missing. You've got all these tools. Now you've got a way to synthesize, to act upon it, to remediate it promptly. But also, very important, to show the boss, the board, the C-suite, the compliance auditors, what you've done, what you're doing. Enterprise security teams use PlexTrack to streamline their pen tests and security assessments, their incident response reports, and much more. PlexTrack clients report up to a 60% reduction in time spent reporting. That's the templating. You're not sitting there typing this stuff in by hand, doing it all manually. 30% increase in efficiency. And this is probably important to your boss. 5x ROI in year one. All in all, PlexTrack provides a single source of truth for all stakeholders, transforming the cybersecurity management lifecycle. I really think you want this. Book a demo today to see how much time PlexTrack could save your team. Try it free for a month. But I got to warn you, do that. You're never going to want to give it up. See how much it will improve the effectiveness and efficiency of your security team. By the way, this is great because it's very fast to get up and running. It's easy to learn, simple. But boy, it is the lever that you want to move what you're doing ahead. Go to plextrack.com/twit. Claim your free month. plextrac.com/twit. This is a must-have tool for everybody in the security business. plextrack.com/twit. We thank them so much for supporting Security Now. And you support us too. But you got to go to that address so they know you saw it here. plextrack.com/twit. Now, back to you, Steve.
So, if any of our listeners are looking for something to do, the Karakurt group, with known ties to former Conti gang members and known for its hack and leak extortion operations, announced this week that they are recruiting people to breach networks, code malware, socially engineer people, and extort companies for payments. And of course, I'm not serious about any of our listeners wanting a job there, but their online posting was wonderful. So just to back up a little bit, Karakurt, K-A-R-A-K-U-R-T, Karakurt, gets its name from a type of Black Widow spider. It's not a ransomware gang. They don't bother with encryption. They're known for extortion and for demanding ransoms between $25,000 and as much as $13 million payable in Bitcoin. They don't target specific sectors or industries. They're an equal opportunity, denizen. The gang backs up their claims of stolen data using screenshots and copies of exfiltrated files as proof that they've been in someone's network, and they threaten to sell or leak the data publicly if they don't receive a payment. And they're not very patient. Karakurt typically sets a one-week deadline to pay. Until they're paid, they bully their victims by harassing their employees, business partners, and customers with emails and phone calls, all aimed to pressure the company into paying the ransom. So, not nice people. Okay. Their site on the dark web is a Tor hidden service. So, you know, it's a .onion domain. It contains several terabytes worth of previous victim data, along with press releases naming organizations that had not paid, you know, up in terms of, you know, getting ransom, and instructions for buying victims' data. The site surfaced in May. The miscreants usually break into networks by either purchasing stolen login credentials, using third-party initial access brokers that we've spoken about extensively previously. Those are brokers that sell access to compromised systems, or by abusing security weaknesses in the network's infrastructure. Okay, so this brings us to their so-called great recruitment posting recently, last week, on the dark web. Since it was interesting and somewhat entertaining, I thought it would be worth sharing. Now, they're Russians, but I found myself thinking, wow, okay, they're not having a translation problem into English in this instance. The posting is well translated into English. They wrote in this posting, the Karakurt team is glad to announce some news. more than a year in private mode, but now we open the great recruitment. You can join our honorable mission to make companies pay for the existing gaps in their cybersecurity and for the inaction of their IT staff. So, our dear hack lovers, what we have for you, : are you an experienced pen tester and for some reason do not want to work with ransomware operators? We can find a better place in our team, meaning they don't do ransomware. Otherwise, they're every bit as evil. Do you work for a company that you hate with all your heart? Or maybe your boss fired you but forgot to turn off your network access? You can find solace in our arms. You are a bearer of a sacred knowledge of malware coding, disassembling, exploit developing. The Karakurt team is ready to set interesting and non-trivial tasks for research, implementation of specialized software, and modification of toolkits. Are you from the financial industry? Do you know how to make money on quotes of companies whose shares are in poor condition? Know how to sell data in a specific market? We will hug you and love you more than anyone has ever loved you before. Are you from a data recovery company and know us? Let's be friends, maybe even best friends. Do you have social engineering experiences? There is also a vacancy. Want to take revenge on capitalism through cyberspace? We will find you both a vacancy and a psychologist. Perhaps you're a crazy researcher. We're really waiting for you, bro. The best hacker group, Karakurt, is waiting for you, our dear hack lover. So, the good news is, that's not being seen by most people who are not visiting the dark web. And I assume if you're visiting the dark web, you're either a security researcher who is not interested or you're a bad guy who might be. Anyway, now you know. Karakurt has their arms wide open, ready to love you more than you've ever been loved. Okay, and speaking of job offers, over the summer, the U.S. government held what they called a cybersecurity apprenticeship sprint. As a result of that, 7,000 apprentices were hired in official cybersecurity roles, with around 1,000 of the new hires being sourced from the private sector. The sprint was launched in July by the White House and the Department of Labor as a way to boost the government's cybersecurity workforce. Okay. I mentioned a web server from the Dark Ages. The security firm Recorded Future found that a Chinese advanced persistent threat actor had leveraged a vulnerability in an IoT device to gain access to an electrical grid operator in India. And in a report last week, Microsoft said that they had identified the entry point for the attack. It was a tiny, somewhat obscure web server known as BOA. It's www.boa.org. And actually, I was surprised that there was a three-letter .org. Those are rare. And it's only due to the fact that it's been around for a long time. BOA, which is said to be widely used across the IoT and ICS, that's industrial control system space. Okay, as we all know, it can be very handy to have a nice, simple, and tight little web server. So tiny that it could even be considered a component. Although BOA is written for Unix-like operating systems, it doesn't use the traditional Unix fork and spawn approach of creating multiple instances of itself to handle individual incoming connections. I didn't study BOA long enough to determine whether it's multi-threaded, thus spawning a new thread for each request. It might be purely serializing, Since the Unix Berkeley Sockets TCP IP stack supports a queue of waiting connections, BOA might simply accept one connection after another using a single thread of execution. That would indeed make it quite lean. And apparently, BOA is also quite fast. Of course, you get that until you overload it by an HTTP server that is so simple. Okay, all of that is okay. But here's the problem. It's not that BOA was first written and released 27 years ago in 1995. That's fine. The problem is that the last attention its source code received was 17 years ago, back in February of 2005. In looking through BOA's development history, I noticed...
Is this the
some
website?
Yes, my friend.
It looks very...
That makes mine look modern.
It's very... not last updated February 2005.
Uh-huh.
And it's, you know, I couldn't pull it up because it's not HTTPS. I had to just...
Oh, no.
No.
Nor is the web server, Leo.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Okay. So if you click on news, that first link there, click on... And then if you scroll down to the 2002 Developers Conference.
Oh, yeah. The big BOA Developers Conference. Who could forget that?
Well, yeah. In fact, I have a picture of the Developer Conference attendees.
What a party.
In the show notes. I noted with some interest.
It was just two of them.
On October 4th and 5th of 2002, the BOA Developers Conference was held. The official minutes of the event noted, quote, Larry and one of his sons stayed at John's house October 4th and 5th, 2002. While the reasons were unrelated to BOA development, and in fact, Larry and John spent only a few hours discussing BOA, computers, and the free world, it seemed appropriate to refer to the event as a developers conference. Well, here is a picture.
It's the team.
Here is, yeah, the entire team in one location. Here is a picture of Larry and John at John's house. Left to right, John, Larry. Now.
Oh, my goodness.
This web server is in... is in an IoT device which is being used by the grid operators of, what was it that I said? Israel?
India. No. India.
India, right. So, you know.
Well, the price was right, I guess.
Oh, it certainly was. I have no doubt that these two have their hearts in the right place if they're still beating.
If they're around, yeah.
But a web server... they wrote 27 years ago and last tweaked 17 years ago, which has no support for secure connections, is currently in use, and apparently widely so, because it's apparently very popular, among other places, the operation of an electrical grid operator in India. Lord only knows where else this BOA constrictor might be lurking.
There are a lot. I mean, there are a lot of mini specialty web servers. That's a simple thing.
Yeah, it takes about an afternoon.
Yeah,
it takes an afternoon to write one these days.
Yeah. But wow, why they chose this one is a baffling.
It's tiny, right? Yeah. So it's like, we're going to put it in ROM. Who got the smallest server? Oh, look, BOA. Oh, and you didn't bring up their logo page on that site, Leo. It's pretty good. These are if you want to put a logo on your homepage when you've used the BOA constrictor server in order to serve your pages. You can pick from any of these.
I'm going to put this on my website just for fun. Powered by BOA, the high perform. When you feel the need for speed.
I like the one with the colored scales.
That's
good.
That's nice. Yeah. That'd look good on my site.
Anyway, unfortunately, IoT devices on the net are powered by BOA. And that we there was Microsoft didn't specify the way in, but China found a way in. And it's not surprising. I did a search on their errata page for null, and I found lots of null pointer problems in the past. So presumably not all of them.
But good news, it's Y2K compliant.
Yes. Yes. Your concerns from 22 years ago about Y2K have been addressed. Larry and John did it by phone. They did. They decided not to have a developers conference for that because, and there actually is, they go on at some length on their explanation page about Y2K. And while the underlying OS may have a problem with it, at least their code doesn't.
Yeah.
So rest assured, if your clock is set wrong, you'll be okay.
I noticed they copied their Y2K statement from the Apache project. So I guess they were aware of that other little web server out there.
No need to reinvent the wheel.
No, that's right.
Unfortunately, they didn't copy their TLS support from Apache, so they don't have any.
Wow.
Okay, so the dilemma of closed source Chinese networking products. I dislike the idea of, and I know you do too, Leo, of banning foreign companies from selling their products to whomever wants to purchase them. And the idea that networking and surveillance cameras of Chinese origin might incorporate designed-in Trojan capability, it does seem a little bit far-fetched to me. Presumably, such cameras are not phoning home to China, but are networked locally. So the first instant that unexplained data was caught transiting the wire, there would be hell to pay. But at the same time, we cannot prove the negative, right? We have no way of proving that there isn't any backdoor Trojan capability present in Chinese network and surveillance cameras. So I suppose that the recent actions from the U.S. and the U.K. are understandable. Last Friday, November 25th, both the U.S. and U.K. governments banned the use of Chinese networking and surveillance equipment, citing national security-related fears as the grounds for their decisions. The U.S. Federal Trade Commission has banned the import and sale of networking and video surveillance equipment from Chinese companies Dahua, Hikvision, Huawei, and ZTE. And I know that at least Dahua and Hikvision are state-owned companies. And we talked about Hikvision not long ago with regard to some badness that they were caught with. So in the UK, the parliament has instructed government departments to cease the development of security cameras, I'm sorry, the deployment of security cameras from Chinese companies on, quote, sensitive sites, unquote, such as government buildings and military bases. British officials said the Chinese-made security cameras should not be connected to core networks and that government departments should also consider removing and replacing existing equipment even before scheduled upgrades. U.S. and U.K. bans come after both countries' intelligence agencies warned against the use of equipment from Chinese companies, cautioning that Chinese equipment could be used for digital surveillance, digital sabotage, and economic espionage. Again, of course, they're not wrong, but we already do lots of even dumber things, like deploying proprietary design, closed source voting machine technology in critical elections. You know, how do we know what those machines are doing? Both Dahua and Hikvision had already lost a large chunk of their market in the U.S. after the U.S. Treasury Department sanctioned the companies for providing the Chinese government with facial recognition and video tagging solutions in the government's efforts to oppress the Uyghurs. And I recall, as I mentioned, that Hikvision was on our radar separately for something that they were doing maybe 6 months ago or so. We've talked about this a lot in the past. I noted that it was hard to believe that Russia was still using the American-made closed-source Windows OS when hostilities between the U.S. and Russia have been so aggravated. And it's also amazing that until now, the U.S. has been deploying Chinese-made networking gear while having absolutely no idea what's inside the box. In the past, we've even discussed the existence of counterfeit Cisco networking gear, since Cisco equipment is all manufactured in China. Both the real and the clearly counterfeit equipment all comes from the same place. How do we know what the counterfeit systems are going to do? And the burden of trust is really not symmetrical. Due to Chinese massive manufacturing and fabrication capability, they receive Western technology from us, and the West purchases the resulting Chinese products from the East. Thus, more trust is required from the rest than is from the East. So I suppose my point is we cannot discount such concerns as being, you know, purely hyperbolic and inflammatory. Our dependence upon our networks and digital infrastructure has slowly but surely been growing through the last several decades. So it's only natural that at some point, someone at the national government level is going to wake up one morning and pose the big, but what if question to their staff. You know, it's that, but what if that was the driving factor behind the recent decision to just say no to Chinese networking and video equipment. And unfortunately, their protectionism that results, I think, is both sane and rational. Even if you can't prove that anybody's doing anything wrong, you know, what if? And, you know, the equipment we're buying is just a black box. We plug it in and we assume it's going to be okay, but we have no ability to prove that that's the case. It really is a dilemma that we've gotten ourselves in. And all I can see is that over time, between countries where there are clear hostility, we're just not going to be able to trust equipment from each other. And, you know, I think that's what has to happen until and unless open source ultimately wins, as I argue, and I know you agree, Leo.
Wow.
It ultimately should.
Oh, I didn't realize you were a complete fan.
Oh, yeah.
Good.
Yeah.
I am too. Yeah. Yeah.
I absolutely think
we're really learning that lesson over and over and over, frankly.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. MIT recently published its rankings of national cyber defense by nation. Interestingly, at the top of the list for the best defense, cyber defense, is Australia. In second place is the Netherlands. Third place goes to South Korea. And we here in the U.S., we just eke out Canada a little bit. We're in fourth place with Canada's in fifth. So those are the top five: Australia, Netherlands, South Korea, U.S., and Canada. Then the way MIT, so they did the top 20. So the way they organized it is top five is green. Then the middle 10, they lumped together. That's Poland, the U.K., France, Japan, Switzerland, Italy, China, Germany, Spain, and Saudi Arabia in descending order. And then the bottom five, they set them out separately as red. And that's in order of descending security: Mexico, India, Brazil, Turkey, and Indonesia. So anyway, just sort of an interesting ranking. And it's interesting that Australia, you know, is solid. And they got a 7.83. This was all ranked out of 10. So they got a 7.83. The U.S. is 7.13. So a bit of a drop, although Indonesia at the very bottom of this 20 is 3.46. So it's possible to be doing a bad job. I just wanted to make a quick note for our listeners to be careful about Docker Hub images. It turns out that the security firm Sysdig scanned the official Docker Hub portal and identified 1,652 malicious Docker images, which have been uploaded, as I said, on that official Docker Hub portal. More than a third contained crypto mining code, you know, making somebody some money if you just run that Docker and don't pay any attention to what it's doing, while others contained hidden secret tokens that the attacker could later use as a backdoor into a server that was running a Docker and exposed publicly. Other Docker images contain proxy malware or dynamic DNS tools. So anyway, just be careful. You know, they are seductively easy to grab and deploy. They're very cool, but not everyone who's creating and making them available for everyone is doing so out of the goodness of their heart. So a word of warning. We've been tracking 0 days for a while. I wanted to note that Google just fixed Chrome's 8th zero day of the year. So they're doing better than they were last year. They updated Chrome to eliminate CVE 2022-4135, which, no surprise, was a heap buffer overflow. It was found and exploited in Chrome's GPU component. The vulnerability was discovered by one of Google's tag researchers and is now history. So 8 for Chrome for the 80 days for 2022. And, you know, I imagine they'll get through the rest of the year. We'll see. CISA, the Cybersecurity Information Security Administration, is now on Mastodon, Leo, after a fake account was spotted for CISA's director, Jen Easterly, on Mastodon. CISA now has an official account on the platform. The account is at the very popular infosec.exchange server, which is turning out to be where most of the industry's security researchers have been hanging out and hanging their hat. So infosec.exchange/@CISACyber is the handle, CISACYBER.
They need to add a icon and some verification.
Yeah, they didn't.
I'm not
going to
follow them until they put a little more effort into their account.
They didn't do very much.
It's one of the nice things about Mastodon, by the way, 1,400 people already do follow, is that it's very easy to verify that you are who you say you are. All a CISA has to do is put a Mastodon link in the CISA homepage, even can be hidden. It doesn't have to be visible. And they would be verified. But they
have
so far not posted anything. They're not following anybody. They haven't put in an icon or are they verifying their links. But I'll take your word for it. They're the real deal. You've seen this posted at CISA's site or something? Or
no, I did. I picked up a news blurb about it in the InfoSec community. So.
Yeah. That is a good server, by the way, if you're in InfoSec. It's a good one to follow. So CISA Gen is not real.
Correct.
That account has been suspended. But CISA, which is CISA Cyber at infosec.exchange, is apparently
the real
guys. I'll follow them. I'll let you know if anything.
And you're right. Let's hope they go the next step because come on, guys.
Come on.
That's sloppy.
All you have to do is follow one person.
That's very cool.
Yeah.
It's good
that they're there. You know, infosec.exchange has a lot of really good people on it. And I should mention that Alex Stamos, speaking of InfoSec, will be on Twig tomorrow.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. He is, was in charge of InfoSec at Yahoo and then at Facebook, left over the Cambridge Analytica scandal. Not his fault. Yep. He left because they weren't doing the right thing. And he is part of the Krebs Stamos group. He's working with Chris Krebs now doing cybersecurity. So he'll be a great guest tomorrow.
Yeah, Alex
Twig
was first, and then they added Chris to the group.
Yeah, it's really good.
And in fact, he was involved with Zoom in the early COVID-19.
That's right. He was the first person they went to when the people got mad at them for not doing it right during encryption, right, or kind of misrepresenting their encryption. He's also a professor at Stanford, so I think he will be a good guest.
Neat. Tomorrow.
Yeah.
I have one piece of miscellany. It's not directly security related or privacy, but everyone's talking about Twitter and its uncertain future under the reign of Elon. I stumbled upon something that I thought our listeners might find interesting, and I think you might, Leo, as I did, because it appears to contain some actual facts. This is a note written by an unnamed executive director at an unnamed business-to-business organization, but it looks authentic. I presume it's anonymous because he would prefer not to have Elon Musk retaliate against his firm. The title of his posting was, "I told my team to pause our 750,000 per month, so $750,000 per month, Twitter ads budget last week." So here's what he wrote. He said, "I've seen a lot of technical and ideological takes on Elon Twitter." And I got a kick out of that. I wonder whether it was a play on Tim Apple. Anyway, he said, "But I wanted to share the marketing perspective. For background, I'm a director at a medium-sized B2B tech company, not in financial services anymore, running a team that deploys about $80 million in ad spend per year. Twitter was 8 to 10% of our media mix, and we have run cost per engagement, i.e. download a white paper, register for an event, etc., campaigns, successfully since 2016. I had my team keep our Twitter campaigns live for 2 weeks post-takeover on the bet that efficiency would improve with fewer advertisers and that the risks were managed and probably overblown. I was wrong. And I think the things we saw in these last 2 weeks means many more advertisers will bail on the platform in the coming weeks." And he says, parens, "for non-ideological or virtue signaling reasons." So then he has some four bullet points. He says, "Performance fell significantly. CPMs didn't drop," meaning same number of eyeballs. He said, "but our engagement went way down. Maybe it's a shift in users on the platform. Maybe it's ad serving related." Second point, "serious brand safety issues." He said, "our organic social and CS teams got dozens of screenshots of our ads next to awful content. Replies to our posts with hardcore anti-Semitism and adult spam remained up for days even after being flagged." Third, "our entire account team at Twitter turned over multiple times in 2 weeks. We had multiple people," he said, "AE, AM, analyst, creative specialist, supporting our account, and they all vanished without so much as an email. We finally got an email with a name for an AM, I guess that means account manager, last week, but they quit, and we don't have a new one yet." And finally, he said, "ads UI is very buggy, and login with single sign-on and two-factor authentication broken. One of my campaign managers logged in last week and found all our paused creatives from the past 6 years had been reactivated. Campaign changes don't save. These things cost us real money." Anyway, I wonder if
they put any prices with the decimal point in the wrong place up by accident. Now that could cost you.
You know, since I hadn't encountered anything as substantive as that, I thought that it was interesting to see. And I understand a bit about what's going on from the perspective of, you know, one of Twitter's advertisers who views the service dispassionately. He doesn't care one way or another who's doing what, except he dislikes the idea of their ads appearing to endorse horrific content, which it's now appearing next to or in the comments that follow an ad. For him, Twitter is just either an ends to a means. Wait, a means to an end or maybe not. So, anyway,
yeah, he's
I thought
just
that
a
was
business person. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And in a related piece, in a security newsletter I recently scanned, the statement was made, quote, some threat intelligence companies are telling their customers that they can no longer guarantee takedowns of malicious or reputation-damaging content from Twitter, as there is nobody in Twitter's abuse team to respond to requests anymore.
Hmm.
So another data point from a different direction. And for what it's worth, TweetDeck is behaving weirdly now. I always go in order to pull feedback from largely my DMs, although I scan the public feed, the at SGGRC postings. And it was definitely not working the way it used to, and not in a way that I liked. So something is changing or has changed. And I don't know. I don't care to know what that is. Did we do our last spot? I don't think we did.
We have one more if you'd like to.
I think we need
pause
to.
We're
an hour and 11 minutes in, and I need some water.
This episode of Security Now is brought to you by NordLayer. NordLayer safeguards your company's network and data, and it does it in a very clever and I think a very useful way. A lot of companies really will appreciate what NordLayer does. With a surge of ransomware attacks, employees choosing a remote work, businesses have become more vulnerable than ever. That's kind of what every ad says these days. I mean, it's clearly the case. And if you're working in network security, it's tough. Now, NordLayer is a really nice tool for all of this. It secures and protects remote workforces as well as business data, and it can help you ensure security compliance. With NordLayer, it's easy to start. It'll take less than 10 minutes to onboard your entire business onto a secure network. So that's where it starts, right? The NordLayer secure network. You can easily add new members. You can create teams, private gateways. You can even do things like IP whitelists, allow lists, site-to-site connection. Network segmentation is possible. Setting up secure network access. Right now, what I would say, if you're at all interested, go to NordLayer, NordLayer.com/twit. You can get 1 month free right now with the purchase of an annual subscription. It's easy to combine. Tools. It's hardware free. It's compatible with all major operating systems. It allows you to implement security features across all teams. We always talk about security as being layered. This is an important layer. You can add two-factor authentication, single sign-on. You can even require biometrics, threat block, smart remote access. NordLayer scales easily as you choose a plan unique to your business requirements and your rate of growth. You'll have everything centrally in one place where you can check server usage, monitor connections to your gateways, view the activity log. One NordLayer user said, quote, we were looking for an easy way to securely connect our remote workforce to our infrastructure. This is it. Awesomely quick, friendly, efficient support. Got us up and running in no time. Another said, simple to install and operate. No funny business. And so fast that our teams don't notice they're using it. That's pretty important, too. With most modern businesses already adopting network solutions like SASE, Zero Trust, Hybrid Work Security, NordLayer does that. All of that and more. Built in. Don't lead your businesses vulnerable. Try NordLayer today. Join the more than 7,000 fully protected organizations. NordLayer. If you want to secure your business network, go to NordLayer.com/twit. Get your first month free when you buy an annual subscription. NordLayer. NordLayer.com/twit. Thank them so much for support and security now. And we thank you for supporting security now by going to NordLayer.com/twit. That's important, that slash twit part, so they know you saw it here. Back to Steve.
Yes, otherwise they think that their ads on the shopping channel.
They don't know. They don't know. How would they know? They don't know. You came in the door. You got the stuff. We just want them to know that you heard it here. That's all.
Okay, so Carrie on Anon is his name. It's Mr. Indigo is his Twitter handle. He said, hi, Steve. Finally listening to latest episode 898. And I started wondering, is quantum computing going to be just a faster way to guess passwords? Or is there another attack vector? In other words, is it just going to be a faster way to brute force attack passwords? Okay, interestingly enough, once we get quantum computing, assuming that we ever get quantum computing, it won't be any faster at brute forcing passwords. In fact, it would likely be far slower and vastly more expensive than conventional hardware accelerated hash based password brute forcing.
How interesting. That's not the problem.
No, there's just a class of things it's good at. The rest, it's really crappy at. You know, it's like, you know, it's like weather prediction. That's it. It can do that, but it can't tell you where a specific drop of rain is going to land. And that's what you need for symmetric crypto and hashing, is, you know, is that kind of exact operation. The important thing to understand here is that some of today's crypto, but only some of it, depends upon the traditional time-proven difficulty of factoring a very large number into its two half as large prime number components. That's it. That's all that the, you know, fervor surrounding quantum computing is about. The ability to do that, a couple of things quickly that are entirely insurmountable, that is this factorization problem. But it's only the asymmetric key crypto that quantum computing might be able to someday weaken. None of the other crypto that we also depend upon today will be affected. Symmetric key crypto, like our beloved AES ciphers or today's strong hashing algorithms, will not be affected at all. And they don't need to be changed. I was thinking about quantum computing after I read this guy's note, and I was looking for a good analogy of the effort, you know, its promise and the difficulty that it presents. And what popped into my head as being an almost, like in almost every way similar, was power generation at scale via nuclear fusion. It's a useful analogy. It requires crazy, way out there, new physics and new materials and new technologies. And like quantum computing, fusion has been chased for decades, driven by the promise of what if, just like quantum computing has. And incredible amounts of ingenuity and money have been sunk into it. Many different approaches have been tried and discarded. And yes, we are creeping forward little by little, inch by inch, tantalizingly, just enough to keep the investment cash flowing. But boy, is fusion a difficult nut to crack. In order to fuse matter, we must create, contain, and compress the hottest plasmas humans have ever handled. Hotter, it turns out, than the sun. And at this point, it's as much art as science. You know, will we get there someday? Maybe. Maybe not. It's still not clear. But as with quantum computing, we do appear to be making some progress year after year, learning as we go. So, as for quantum computing, my feeling is that there's no reason not to replace that small but crucial portion of our large crypto library of algorithms, which are believed to be currently unsafe. If quantum computing ever happens, we can replace it with algorithms which are believed to be quantum safe. We just don't want to make any mistakes with our replacements. And there's no reason to believe that there's any big hurry. We might well have free electricity once we figure out how to burn water before quantum computers threaten our current dependence on today's asymmetric crypto. So, not to worry. Another listener who requested anonymity, and I'll explain why in a second, he said, "Hi, Steve. In the last episode of Security Now, you talked about passkeys.directory, which lists web applications that support passkeys. I wanted to share my observations with you. First, the website owner chose to manage it with no transparency, When I saw it, I thought there must be a Git repo where I could open an issue for a change request. Surprisingly, they chose to use Google Forms, which masks all the review and approval process. And he's talking about, you know, passkeys.directory. Second, he said, I've noticed that many companies in this list are also customers of OwnID, which is listed as the authentication provider, including Carnival Cruises.
Oh, interesting.
Yes. Yes. They did not do it natively. And he says, and then investigating the OwnID flow. He said, when Leo pressed the fingerprint button, the QR code encoded a URL that sent his iPhone to passwordless.carnival.com with a session identifier. Then he performed a web authentication on his iPhone. Once completed, the session got updated on the server and the browser on his laptop logged in. The flow is using WebAuthn's passkeys, but not likely the way it was designed to be used. WebAuthn phishing resistance mechanism works in a way that a JavaScript API called on the browser triggers the underlying library and matches the domain key. Matches the domain a key was registered in and the domain asking to authenticate. By implementing WebAuthn as it is in Carnival, the phishing resistance mechanism suffers from a flaw. As an attacker, you can spoof Carnival's login page, so the user sees the same page, only a different domain. When you click the biometrics button, the attacker's backend will send a request to Carnival to get a QR code, which encodes the passwordless.carnival.com. Then the phone would ask you for your face or fingerprint to authenticate with a passkey, which will update the session on the backend, and the attacker gets in. Actually, this is the thing that I spent a lot of time on Squirrel solving completely, and, you know, it's crucial. He says, the right way to implement passkeys is by calling the WebAuthn API on the laptop's browser. He says, instead of presenting the QR that will open a browser on the mobile phone, and letting the browser do its job, presenting native WebAuthn screens, including a QR which is scannable from a mobile phone. This way, the domain you're authenticating to is passed in a side channel, that is, you know, push versus BLE, Bluetooth Low Energy, from the browser to the phone. He says, to the mobile phone directly from the browser, and a phishing site will be blocked as the credential on the phone was registered under the original domain. Okay, so first of all, our listener who wrote this to me is 100% correct. And by the way, he's a developer for an authentication provider who asked for anonymity. Another way to say this is that rather than doing the work of upgrading their own servers to become a first-party passkeys provider, Carnival Cruises, and unfortunately a lot on that list, has outsourced their authentication responsibility to a third-party provider, in this case, OwnID. But in doing so, by punting in this way, they've bypassed passkeys phishing protections. This gives their users the false belief that they're getting the hack-proof benefits of passkeys without actually getting them. This could be transient. We can hope not. But on the other hand, OwnID is in the business of doing this. So they're going to presumably keep selling their instant onboarding services. And most websites will simply want easy login without really caring about their visitors' security. So we've seen the first way that passkeys will fail. And that is, it is when implemented like this, you can be phished. And that was a big deal. It was supposed to be anti-phishing. Well, it's only anti-phishing if you don't turn the responsibility over to a third party. And if you do, and this page of people have, you're not getting the benefit of passkeys. All you're getting
that's disappointing,
is,
but of course, to be predicted.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
Christopher Ursich, he said, SN topic request, hardware security modules. He said you had one. Besides the technical crypto, can you describe how you interact with it in practice to sign your code? Sure. Just as there are EV, extended validation TLS certificates for web servers, there are EV code signing certificates. I have no idea whether they are any better or more trusted than non-EV code signing certificates, but I'll take every advantage I can get. And one requirement of EV code signing is that they must, without exception, be protected by a hardware security module so that the EV private key can only ever be used for signing and cannot possibly escape into the wild. The EV code signing key, which I purchased from DigiCert, was packaged in a Gemalto USB dongle, which is paired with the SafeNet authentication client. Somehow, when I use the same Authenticode code signing command in Windows, as I've always used, that SafeNet client is invoked. The hash of the file I'm signing is sent to the key and signed inside there, and it returns a signed blob. So it's just a matter of having a free USB port and installing a hardware interface client. Part of the effort, which I'll be engaged in toward the end of the work to publish the final SpinRite 6.1 code, which will be, like 6.0 is, a hybrid DOS and Windows app, will be automating this code signing process server-side, since each owner's copy of SpinRite embeds their license information, which makes their executable unique, each one needs to be individually code-signed on the fly by the server as it's downloaded. What's going to be really annoying is that Windows Defender will always be complaining for every single user that the user-specific custom SpinRite file is not commonly downloaded, unquote, thus needlessly warning and alarming its users. You know, we've seen that no degree of reputable signing is able to bypass this alarm. I discovered that when I, signed, the final version of Squirrel, when I updated the DNS benchmark, people said, hey, Windows Defender's not happy. And I said, I know. Doesn't matter if you sign, and those were EV certificate signed. Windows Defender says, I haven't seen this a lot before. And you can understand, it's going to take a hash of the things that you want to download, and it's obviously sharing those in the cloud. And when it sees enough of those and no complaints, then it goes, okay, it must be okay, and stops, bringing up warning messages. Unfortunately, SpinRite's users are just going to have to get used to that, because every one of those that they download is going to be unique. Two people, Dan Gard asked, Steve, how can I get access to test the pre-release version of SpinRite 6.1? Feel free to email me or just respond here. Thanks so much for your work on SpinRite. I have drives waiting for 6.1. And SD Holden asked, hey, Steve, not sure the best way to reach you about the Git server for SpinRite, so I thought I'd start here. When I try to create an account, I get a dialog box asking me to sign in instead of allowing me to create a registration. He says, ... Okay, so to both listeners and everyone else, in case some of you hadn't noticed, the internet has sadly become a sewer full of both bots trolling constantly and even human labor farms being paid for creating accounts online. I've been running two web forum servers for years, despite having all manner of entrance barriers erected, like even requiring the correct answer to the question, what software is Steve best known for? In order to create an account, 5 out of 6 of the account registrations were bogus in those forums. Like, how does a bot know?
How hard
know?
Is that? How hard is that to, yeah, a bot wouldn't know, but.
No, I know. At one point, we had 6,500 users registered in GRC's forums, and I was thinking, wow, I haven't even talked about it that much. Okay, now that number is a bit over 1,100 after I spent several days working to get that under control.
Yeah.
5,500 of those were registered in Afghanistan and Turkey and Indonesia. I mean, it's just like, and Russia, and, you know, it was so annoying.
Spammers love forums. They really
do. Oh, my God. Yeah. Yes. So I've erected much tougher barriers since, and I've mostly gotten it under control. And since I erected those stronger barriers, 20,204 additional account creation attempts have been thwarted. So I'd have an additional 20,000 bogus users on top of the 5,500 I had before. The reality is that today, as you said, Leo, running any sort of open web service results in a torrent of bogus registrations. And even with all that in place, the wonderful volunteer moderators I have who make time to read everything are still removing users who attempt to subtly pollute our content. So here's the problem. GRC's forums need to be open. So I have no choice other than to erect the strongest account creation barriers I can, then apologize to those who we mistakenly reject as false positives, and also weed out those who do slip past the barriers due to false negatives. But GRC's GitLab server has no need to be open, so it's closed. Its account creation page is protected by a magic incantation, which must be provided before the troll that guards the bridge will allow newcomers to pass. It requires insider information, which can only be obtained by participating in GRC's old school, blessedly wonderful, text-only NNTP newsgroups. Once someone shows up there and is able to post, they can ask how to satisfy our cantankerous GitLab troll. But also note that we're not using GitLab for any social interaction. We're only using it for issue management. At this point, what I need is feedback from people who are testing SpinRite 6.1. Since we have a handful of known issues to fix, you know, I'll get to that in a moment, it's best for newcomers to join and catch up on all the various threads in the news group in order to eliminate duplicate postings of already known problems. So, if anyone is really and truly interested in participating in SpinRite 6.1's testing, you're invited to head over to GRC's discussions page. That's the page at GRC. If you Google grc.com/discussions, it'll take you there, and create a connection to our news server. Find the grc.spinrite.dev group and say hi. And speaking of SpinRite, it's working. As I planned, I updated GRC's primary server to handle downloading of pre-release versions of SpinRite. And last Friday morning, after Thanksgiving, I posted the information in GRC's spinrite.dev newsgroup about where any existing SpinRite owner could go to grab their own copy. I'll share 3 newsgroup anecdotes, which I've edited just a bit for podcast clarity. A few hours after my first release announcement, someone whose handle is DarkWinX posted on Friday at 2:44 p.m. Well, I can already report success with a USB. In my race to find something to eagerly test on, with the short time I had, I grabbed an old USB I received with the purchase of StarCraft II. I figured I'd reformat it with a NIT disk and run SpinRite from there. So I put it in the computer and started a NIT disk. It waited and waited for about 30 seconds. Eventually, the USB was recognized by Windows and showed up, so I could nuke it. I tried it again, and it still took around 30 seconds to load. So I figured, maybe not the best USB to run SpinRite from. So I found another. I thought, why not run SpinRite on the problem USB as a target? So that's what I did. After a level 2 scan, without finding anything wrong, I rebooted, plugged it in, and instant success. That USB now loads inside Windows instantly every time. Looking forward to testing some more. Second comment, Saturday morning, 8:39, Mark Ping posted, finished the level 2 in 2 hours for a 1 terabyte. Then ran level 4 and it took 9 hours, 37 minutes for 1 terabyte, compared with 150 hours before. And then he finished, SpinRite is back, baby. And finally, Dale F., Saturday evening at 10:12 p.m. posted, I have a 500 megabyte laptop drive that I put in a Sabrent portable enclosure. After I dropped it about 2 years ago, it could not be recognized by any PC or by SpinRite 6.0. So I said to myself, just have to wait for 6.1. On Friday, I ran a level 2 with SpinRite's first alpha release, and 1 hour later, it was good as new. Thanks, Steve. Okay, so frankly, SpinRite's first functional pre-release debut could not have gone much better, and it went far better than it might have. Over the weekend, using the feedback provided by the large group of avid testers, we moved SpinRite through 3 more releases to its 4th alpha release by mid-afternoon on Sunday. And with only a few exceptions, it is now working well for everyone. Overall, it's 100% functional in every way that matters. There are a number of things that I need to fix, like SpinRite's various clocks are not continuing to operate while it's deep into data recovery. I recently rewrote that entire data recovery system, and I just forgot to periodically update the clocks while I was in there. So actually, I'm going to change the entire way that works so that it's much better. Another example is that SpinRite's predictions of its remaining time to run is not working right when it started midway into a drive rather than at the beginning. You can start it wherever you want to. Anyway, it was working once and something I did broke that. So I'll fix that. So right now, the newsgroup gang is continuing to pound away on the 4th alpha release, logging everything they encounter in our GitLab instance. While that's underway, my own now highest priority is to make a decision about that next operating system that I'm considering purchasing and moving to. Its licensing deadline, as I mentioned before, is the end of the year. It's either by then or never. So I expect that's what I'm going to be doing this evening. I'll start that. I only think it'll take a couple days. I just want to make sure that I can boot something, the classic Hello World app, both from a BIOS and from a UEFI based machine. Then that says yes, I'm going to go with this OS. Then I'll return to and get SpinRite's DOS executable completely finished. I should mention, I told you this, Leo, before we began recording today, one thing happened this morning that completely caught me off guard. I hired Greg, who's everyone has heard me refer to through the years, 32 years ago. Tomorrow is his 32-year anniversary of employment with GRC. That means that tomorrow he will have been providing technical support for SpinRite for 32 years. Yesterday, he fired up the latest SpinRite 6.1 alpha, and he'd never seen it before. He's seen nothing until, I'd been keeping him and Sue appraised of what was going on. I sent them both an email saying, well, it works. Somewhat to my amazement. So he fired up the latest SpinRite 6.1 alpha, ran it on a bunch of drives he had around. He said that he ran it on a 1 terabyte spinner, which took about 2 hours. And that's about right. Remember, I've thought about half a terabyte per hour is good performance for a spinning drive. And that certainly beats 2 weeks. And still, it wasn't instantaneous because it was a spinning drive. Then he said he scanned a 128 gig SSD in 5 minutes, and he was stunned. So he told me on the phone this morning that he knows the number one question he is certain people are going to be asking once SpinRite's previous users start using 6.1 is how SpinRite 6.1 could possibly be so much faster. It was like, it's like the difference is too much to believe. You know, either 6 was like way slow, or is 6.1 actually doing anything? On the other hand, I should also mention that a whole bunch of people in the news group have actually had it recovering data, recovering drives, things that could never be copied before. We're seeing green R's on the map showing data was problematical and was recovered. So anyway, I'm very excited that I will be able to soon stop talking about it and have it in everybody's hands.
Woo-hoo.
Yeah.
Very, very good news. Thank you for the hard work.
Thank everybody for their support. Yeah. I really appreciate it.
So you said an NTP, your news groups were an NTP. I thought it was Zenforo, or does Zenforo use an NTP? Is that why?
No, Zenforo is the web forums.
Oh, you have news groups in addition to the web forums. I get it.
Yes.
I get it.
News groups I've had forever.
Yeah.
And I love them. They're a little backwater.
Yeah, they sure are.
We get real serious work done.
How do you read a news group these days?
Thunderbird is a really good news group reader.
Okay.
It does a good job of it. On the discussions page, I asked the question of everybody like 6 months ago, and there's like a list of maybe 30 different news NNTP clients. There's only one for iOS, which is called NewsTap. It's a great little little news reader for iOS. There's a bunch of news readers for Android. And a bunch for Linux and Mac and Windows.
Then
so
you host it. It's on your GRC site,
right? It's news.grc.com.
Nice.
And it's been one of the things I've had. So here's the reality: SpinRite 6.1 will ship. It will be perfect. The news groups are why
right.
It will be perfect.
Right.
In this day and age, what once upon a time, back when we had DOS 2 or 3 or 4, I could write a program and it would work everywhere. Those days are gone.
Yes.
I could never do this if it weren't for the guys in the news group. And as I said before, I've got like all these motherboards around now and all these old hard drives because it was like, Steve, the Asus Cranox 327 isn't working. So I go into eBay, Asus Cranox 327. Oh, yeah, there it is. And I buy it. So Lori is saying, do we still need all these? Just a little bit longer.
A little bit longer. Yeah, it used to be all the browsers could handle news groups, but they've slowly stripped that out of every browser. So I'm glad.
And, of course, FTP is gone now, too.
It's gone, too. That's right. They take if nobody uses it, it's just a security.
A good generic news reader is Thunderbird.
Yeah.
It's multi-platform, and it's pretty good for getting the job done.
Good. I have to check out the news groups. For some reason, I spaced that you have a news group. I thought it was all forums, which forums are fairly old-fashioned. News groups are positively antediluvian. That's
yes,
good.
And,
I like it.
And the forums are where support will be for SpinRite.
Right.
I'm going to engage community support, but I'm never going to allow, the news groups are my sanctum sanctorum. Is that the right term?
Do you use UUCP and send it off and everybody in the world gets to see it, or is it just hosted on your site?
Actually, we block it going anywhere else. Because Google groups would like to be pulling from an NNTP server. The problem is people were responding to postings that Google had sucked out, and nobody was ever seeing their responses.
Right, right.
So it is closed. I actually have a technology where the IP address of the entity which pulls the article is added to the headers. So if we ever see postings out in public, we can look at the headers and see the IP address that is pulling them, and then I block them.
Oh, so smart. So there. Wow. So it's really, I mean, to call it a news group is really not exactly right, because the whole idea was news groups were federated and they would be copied every night from university.
I've written a whole bunch of extra code.
NNTP protocol for your server.
Yeah. We have something called a CISL ID, which is also added to a posting, which is a hash of the person's username and password, which allows them, the postings to be owned by them.
Right.
Nobody else can delete them, but they can delete their own.
Perfect.
And so there's a whole bunch of other, you know, benefits that we've added over time. So
very
anyway,
interesting.
That's what I'll be using. Like when somebody comes along to turn off the servers after I'm gone, they'll be shutting down the news groups.
Oh, that'll be sad. All right, Steve, always a pleasure. He's the old fashioned way. He does it the old way, but the old ways are often still the best. Steve Gibson is at grc.com along with his news groups. That is the Gibson Research Corporation. You'll find Spin right there, the world's best mass storage recovery and maintenance utility. Now faster than ever. It's really working. It is. It's really doing something. Honest. If you don't have a copy, get 6.0 now. You'll have a free upgrade to 6.1 when it comes out. You can also participate in the development and all of that, as he said. GRC.com. While you're there, you can get a copy of this show. Security Now is hosted at twit.tv, but also at GRC.com. Steve has two unique versions, a 16 kilobit audio version for the bandwidth impaired. He's always done that from day one. And for his transcriptionist, actually, Elaine Ferris, because she writes this all out and she's living in the country with a lot of horses, doesn't have a lot of bandwidth. You can get the transcripts there as well, grc.com, as a 64 kilobit audio file. We have audio and video at our website, twit.tv/SN. There's a YouTube channel for Security Now. That's a great way to introduce somebody to it. Or, you know, if you hear something on here you want to share with other IT professionals, your boss or friends, your spouse, then just clip it at YouTube. That's probably the easiest way to do it. They make that a fairly simple thing to do. Of course, subscribing in your podcast client might even be the best way to get it. That way you'll get it automatically the minute it's available. You can build your collection of all 899 episodes. Whew, that's a lot of episodes. Steve, we will be back here next Tuesday, 1:30 Pacific, 4:30 Eastern, 21:30 UTC. I had to do the math. You can watch us live, live.twit.tv, chat with us live at irc.twit.tv, or if you are fortunate enough to be in the club, you can do it in the Club Twit Discord. Actually, you should join the club if you're not already a member. It supports Steve's efforts plus everything we do here. $7 a month for ad-free versions of the show, access to the Discord. You also get stuff that we don't put out in public, like Hands on Macintosh, Hands on Windows, the Untitled Linux Show, and all of that. Thank you, my friend. Yes.
Happy birthday again.
Thank you.
For your 66th. I want you to hold on to that sign so that in 33 years you can turn it upside down and celebrate
99. Good thinking, Steve. I'll save that. I bet you save old calendars too, don't you?
No.
Thank you, Steve. Have a great week. We'll see you next time on Security.
Bye.
Hey, we should talk Linux. It's the operating system that runs the internet, but your game consoles, cell phones, and maybe even the machine on your desk. You already knew all that. What you may not know is that TwitNow is a show dedicated to it, the Untitled Linux Show. Whether you're a Linux pro, a burgeoning sysadmin, or just curious what the big deal is, you should join us on the ClubTwit Discord every Saturday afternoon for news, analysis, and tips to sharpen your Linux skills. And then make sure you subscribe to the ClubTwit exclusive Untitled Linux Show. Wait, you're not a ClubTwit member yet? Well, go to twit.tv/ClubTwit and sign up. Hope to see you there. Security now.